It's officially 2026, and my New Year's resolution is to prioritize high-quality pieces in my wardrobe. Thanks to Quince, I can already check that off my list. I'm already planning outfits around my new cotton Oxford shirt. It's such a classic, timeless piece that I know I'll be rewearing all year. Need more than just a wardrobe update? Quince has tons of options for the home as well. Maya has had the same dinnerware since college and has finally decided it's time for a refresh, starting with a gorgeous set of ceramic cake plates. Refresh your wardrobe with Quince. Don't wait. Go to quince.com/rehash for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada, too. That's quince.com/rehash to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/rehash.
Guys, this is going to sound like the most champagne tears thing you've ever heard, but I hate the Louvre.
What? You do? That's insane. Tell me why.
They basically have you pay for tickets for a time slot, but then like have the craziest, longest lines. Like they let too many people into the Louvre. They should really limit the amount of tickets they sell every day, but they can get away with it because they're the Louvre. I'm sick of big Louvre. And guess what? I couldn't even really stop and tell you if I like the art was like worth the hype because I couldn't even stop and look at it because
okay, people... What time of day did you go also and what day?
I went midday, but it was a Tuesday or a Wednesday. Like, it was, we picked that because we thought it would be, and it was the morning too. It didn't matter.
That
it
is
was so
weird
crazy
to me because I was also there at this time of year on a weekday and it was not that busy.
I felt like I was in a shopping mall. I think that we should ban smartphones from museums and galleries. I'm sorry to be a boomer on this, but I genuinely think that that would cut the amount of people there in half because
you'll be in a museum and you'll see someone just walk up to something and not even look at it with their eyes, like walk up with their eyes on an iPad, take the photo and take this ugly, you'll see the photo they're taking and it's just angling is so bad, the composition's terrible, they just like snap it and walk away and it's like, what are you posting that to?
I was at a different gallery in Vienna and there was a Monet painting and these girls in front of me, like they were annoying me so much because they were just there to take photos, but it was like a smaller gallery. So it was kind of, I don't know, I just felt very claustrophobic. And this painting, I saw one of them take a photo. Yeah, didn't look at it and then kept moving. And it was clearly just because it was a Monet. And I don't know, like, I'm not trying to be snobby or gatekeepy about art, but I just think that we should, if we banned phones, one, I think it would make the experience more special if you're just having to engage with art in person. But two, I think it would just mean like there are less people in the gallery, which I would really like. It's really hard because I really love going to art galleries, but I get really overwhelmed by crowds. That's why I can't go to the mall.
As a mantra of this podcast, like we need to ban the word gatekeeping because that's not gatekeeping. Like, no, people being obnoxious in a public space that you spent a lot of money on is... you're fair to be annoyed at that, and I hate the immediate assumption that you're an elitist because you want to like engage with art, because why the fuck else are you there? Like, no, people are being obnoxious. I mean I love the Louvre. I had an amazing experience there, but it was like so specific to the context. Like, I was just having a really prolonged bad mental health period and I was traveling around Europe for like a month, and it was so bad that like every museum I went to felt like, you know when things are so bad that like the smallest little things, like having moments of like rest from your anxiety, feels so important and kind of special. So I think being at the Louvre, like, it calmed me down a lot, which is strange, but I think it was just being able to be around the art. And like, I love old things and I love history and I love medieval times, and I felt like really comforted there. It wasn't crazy busy when I went, but also this was my first experience at like a major museum outside of Canada, so maybe that was also why. I just like wasn't used to any other museum, so I thought maybe that was just like the standard. I had a much worse time at the Uffizi in Florence than I did at the Louvre.
That was
because there's more room at the Louvre. Like, the Louvre is fucking massive. I like going underground in that little pyramid.
It's like, massive, but yet I felt like I was holding something up by stopping to look at the art. And I just kind of feel like I need to be able to zone things out. And it's like, I've been to all the major museums in New York. I've been to the National Gallery in DC. Like, I've never had this sort of an experience
Not even at Uffizi, because we were there together, famously.
Oh, well, no, the Uffizi, actually, I forgot about that. Maybe I blocked that out. But
I was, like, so angry the whole time, yeah.
Our friend Mojan and I, like, we were at the Louvre and we spent the whole time just, like, we're two people who are generally trying to keep it positive, and the two of us just became so misanthropic. I was like, well, why would they allow children in here? The children aren't going to remember the art. And then, like,
that's a Disney adult take.
I know. But we were just, like, so mad. And then we were, like, kind of just ended up by the Mona Lisa. And we were like, I guess we should kind of go into this massive crowd to, like, slowly make our way towards the Mona Lisa because it's here. And I actually regret it. I regret seeing the Mona Lisa because what I saw was the worst of humanity. Like, people on FaceTime.
Yeah, but it's so fascinating, though. I kind of love it because it's the most fascinating thing.
When I was at the front, I felt like I was in, like, a really claustrophobic concert crowd. And these women in front of me were taking photos with the Mona Lisa in the background. And I kid you not, there was a woman who was separated from her child. Her child was further back in the crowd. And they were trying to, like, get back together. No one was helping them reconnect. And then one of these women had the audacity to ask this woman if she could get a photo without her in the background. I'm like, we are all sardines in front of the Mona Lisa. And no, ultimately, literally, no one's looking at the Mona Lisa. And it's kind of, it is fascinating because the Mona Lisa is, like, the most reproduced, like, piece of art. We've all seen it a million times, that it almost, like, it should mean something different to see it in person. But because they're so surrounded by the noise and the chaos of people, and ultimately I saw it more through people's phone screens than I saw it in person anyways. But, like, you're so consumed by all of that you can't actually have an experience with it.
It speaks so much to the spiritual value of the Mona Lisa, right? Because, again, it's not this, like, incredible, like, right across from the Mona Lisa is the wedding feast at Cana, which is this massive work of art, huge, so detailed, floor to ceiling work of art. It's amazing. And no one's looking at it because it doesn't have that same currency. And so I think that's what I always find so fascinating about it. I thought it was kind of funny, but it just depends on the mood you're in. If you're, like, already, it depends on what expectations you go in with and also what mood you're in. So I can see myself getting so irritated as well by that. It is insane. And I find Europe, like, every European person in here is going to, they so all the Europeans always come in and they're like, Europe is a continent, not a country. And I'm like, all I have to say is I know, but I've been to many countries in Europe, and a lot of the art that you go to see tends to be overcrowded. Like, I think a lot of the museums and the churches are overcrowded. They try to stuff as many people in there as possible. And it is a bit of a different experience than, like, going to, like, you know, I've gone to the Met several times now, and it's busy, but I never feel like I'm getting shoved up against the art in a way that it's like I'm at a concert or something, in a way that I have felt at different museums in different European countries. But that doesn't mean every country's the same. Don't worry. I can't believe I'm having to, like, tell Europe that, like, I'm not trying to generalize Europe. Sorry, Europeans.
The way people talk about North Americans, it's fair game. My cousin.
Yeah.
My cousin.
We deserve it.
told me I was so American.
Okay,
I was taking a silly selfie. I was being funny, but I was, like, trying to take a selfie with my uncle with our Guinnesses just as a lol. But I was kind of being silly about it. And my cousin, while I was posing, was like, you're so American. And I was like, don't you
never
dare
say that to me again. No, I know.
Never.
And this will be my brief complaint from the other side of the pond, is coming to New York. And I already expected this, but having it, like, actually so in your face, people are so proudly ignorant here in a way that's crazy. And, like, especially about Canada. And I find a lot of Canadians are such cucks about it, where they're just like, it's funny, like, I don't care. And I'll be at these things and people will just be so disparaging about Canada to your face, but in a way that they're like, oh, I don't care about Canada, it's irrelevant. And it's like, who says that? I don't know. It's just, like, so rude. And then Americans get so butthurt when everyone around the world is like, you guys suck. And it's like, well, you do. And it's because you're so proudly ignorant. It's like, everyone. Anyways, I've probably complained about this on the podcast, but the other day I was at a party. I was talking to this girl and I was like, I thought she was from somewhere in Canada for some reason. She was like, ew, what the fuck? No, I could never. And she was like, I'm American. And I was like, I just said 3 seconds ago I'm Canadian. And, like, I'm not proud of Canada. Like, I think Canada's fucked, but it's also like, that's where I'm from. Like, who says that to another person?
Also, she should know that when you're traveling, like, you want to work it into conversation that you're from Canada, not America, because people treat you a lot better when they know
yeah,
you're
everyone
Canadian.
Hates you guys, and for good reason. And it's like, yeah, I don't know. I think when Europeans are haters about America, I'm like, yeah, and fucking justified. Like, talking to people here and they're like, they don't know a single province in Canada. And you're like, that's not cool, that you should be really embarrassed. I legit walked away from a conversation the other day because a guy, I mentioned that my dad, he was asking where my parents were from. And I was like, oh, my dad's from the Maritimes. And he was like, what is that? And I was like, it's the entire eastern coast of Canada. And he was like, couldn't care. I just stopped talking and I walked away. And so many Canadians just kind of laugh it off. And I'm like, I guess, but like, it's also basic rudeness. Like, I don't know. So,
well, that's
my complaint.
Just because they're our neighbors. I think it's like, if they were in a different continent, it would be one thing, but they're our neighbors.
But also, usually you try to be like, I'm sorry, I don't know about this, you know, like, but there's
such, oh, no,
a,
that's
Canada, such a joke
rude.
To
yeah.
them. But at the end of the day, I'm wearing a clown nose because I am here in America on a visa. So, joke's on me.
She loves it.
And speaking of crazy Americans, that is what this episode is about today. So, I'm Maria.
And I'm Hannah.
And this is Rehash, a podcast about the internet phenomena that strike a nerve in our culture, only to be quickly forgotten, but we think are due for a revisiting. This season is about internet subcultures, the stories of how they arrived, thrived, and sometimes died. If you like our show and you want to hear more from us, you can support us on Patreon at patreon.com/rehashpodcast, where we have bonus episodes, weekly mini episodes, and early access to our regular programming. And if you don't want to join the Patreon, feel free to rate and review us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, because that helps us so damn much. So back in 1995, Wired published an article by a writer named Andrew Leonard called Heads Up Mickey. And in it, he basically points to a growing interest in Japanese cultural exports in the West, particularly in anime. And he hypothesizes that someday Japanese shows and films may become just as, if not more popular in the US than Disney. And I'd argue his predictions were true. Japanese cultural exports have become so influential around the world, and especially the US, that it's created an entire subculture of non-Japanese people who have been accused of having an unhealthy obsession with Japan. What are they, Hannah?
Weebs.
Nice.
Hannah, can you give us a little definition of what a weeaboo or weeb is for the listeners, and maybe just a little primer on why they've drawn so much criticism over the years?
So weebs are, I guess they're people, white Americans, I assume.
Not exactly true. Truly, a person who can qualify as a weeb can be of any race. Like, there are many weebs of a variety of different races. So I think not necessarily the case, but I think the image in people's minds of a weeb is a white person. But typically it's just like a non-Japanese Western person.
Okay, so a Western person who is really interested in Japanese culture. I don't know, in my head, I'm like someone who watches a lot of anime, generally absorbed by like other aspects of like Japanese culture. And I suppose like they've garnered criticism over the years online because, well, for one, I guess like the concept of like cultural appropriation. And two, I think that like sometimes they're like overly zealous. Like, it's not just that they have an interest in Japanese culture, it's like over the top and borders on like fetishistic. So I would say, like, yeah, that's sort of my general understanding of the weebs.
Absolutely. I think the fetishistic aspect is kind of the linchpin of the definition, because there's a lot of divide within communities of people who are interested in Japanese media as to who qualifies as a weeb, and almost all of them will say that a weeb is someone who fetishizes Japan. So like someone who kind of feels an entitlement over it, feels like because they watch a lot of anime, in some ways they're like also kind of spiritually Japanese, will tell other people that they're wrong about Japan, like just be a little bit of know-it-alls, and also kind of exoticize it in a way where it's like, it's looking at Japan through this lens that's been filtered for them through the media they consume, rather than like a country with people and like nuance and a very rich history. And so that's kind of the idea.
Is Gwen Stefani a weeb?
Yes. And I'm glad you said it off top because I wasn't even going to, I forgot to bring her up in this episode. Yes, she is a weeb. I think that she's the perfect example of it because she had that era where she was kind of like employing these Japanese girls, making music about Harajuku girls, selling, what was her perfume called?
Well, LAMB, Love Angel Music Baby, was the line. And so she had like the Harajuku girl perfumes and they were like these bottles.
Which I owned.
That I had the Gwen one. Yeah. I got it for my birthday one year from one of my friends. But yeah, Gwen Stefani, Harajuku Girls, I loved that song.
Loved that song. I mean, and it's a good song sonically.
Yeah. I mean, it's a great album. But I think at the time that she was putting that out, I was obviously like too young to be really thinking critically about why what she was doing might be worth criticizing.
Totally. And it was pre-cultural appropriation discussions. But Gwen Stefani, famous for that. I mean, she's my Indian queen, Bindi legend.
And she did say that she was a Japanese woman like 2 years ago, which...
Great. So awesome.
Delulu.
Delulu queen. Yeah, and it's kind of like the same as that, like, Avril Lavigne song, Kawaii. Like, is it called Kawaii?
Oh my god, the Hello Kitty one. Kawaii, whatever.
Yeah, that one. It's like these, like, white women kind of ornamenting themselves with Japanese women at their sides, like, kind of flanking themselves with Japanese women and making Japanese culture out to be this, like, adorable, cutesy little thing, kind of idealizing it, which is not good. Worth criticizing. Urban Dictionary defines a weeb as a non-Japanese person who basically denounces their own culture and calls themselves Japanese, which... is literally Gwen Stefani. But to be honest, it was difficult to find information or even like a lot of evidence of actual weebs on the internet. Like, I think it's something you would have to just kind of come across. And of course, like, I've come across weebs in my life, or like people I would maybe consider weebs. But generally, because it's a derogatory term, you're not going to find a lot of people being like, we're weebs online. And so... because I think we all understand the criticism of weebs, and I think it's going to be redundant to have an entire episode being like, don't fetishize other cultures. We kind of know that. We've said it off top. So instead, I kind of thought it'd be interesting to make this episode more about how the weeb was born, like tracing it back to Japan, following it to America, and seeing how this culture blossomed, and maybe like trying to understand why it blossomed and why people have this fascination with Japan that borders on obsessive. I think even the briefest of histories of like 20th century Japan will at least help to contextualize our understanding of how it came to be so culturally powerful in the past few decades. This is a very crude history, the most crude rundown you can get. I am not Japanese. I don't live in Japan. I haven't been to Japan, although I would love to. So I am going to be skipping over like large chunks. This isn't the most nuanced take. I just think it'd be good to hit the points. So we kind of ground ourselves in the cultural context. Essentially, Japan, which was an Axis power during World War II, surrenders in the summer of 1945. And at this point, their infrastructure and economy has been crippled completely. Then something happens, which they call the economic miracle, where Japan's economy undergoes this astonishing recovery. And it essentially grows extremely quickly and extremely steadily for a sustained 4 decades. Then something happens, which they call the economic miracle, where Japan's economy undergoes this astonishing recovery, and essentially the economy grows extremely quickly, extremely steadily for a sustained 4 decades, which is insane, from 1945 to 1991. There are multiple factors that contributed to this accelerated growth, which Berkeley's Economic Review lists as technological change, accumulation of capital, increased quantity and quality of labor, and increased international trade. All of a sudden, everyone in the US is driving Toyota, for example. Suck it, Ford. How embarrassing. And also, Japanese cars are just better. Also, in the immediate post-war years, there's an American occupation happening in Japan from 1945 to 1952, which, along with their growing competitiveness in the global market economy, leads to a lot of division and debate in Japan about the collapse of cultural traditions and fears over a Western influence over Japanese youth. Tokyo Story is this amazing movie by Ozu Yasujiro. It's one of the best movies grappling with these cultural anxieties. Everyone should watch it. Incredible. Have you heard of the word otaku, Hannah?
No, I haven't.
Okay, let me tell you.
Yee.
So back in the 60s, there was this growing class of Japanese youth who were starting to rebel against entrenched political and cultural institutions, and also during this time started engaging with like new radical types of media, one of these being manga. Manga at this point was essentially, it was like illustrated books, many of them made for children, but now university-age students were like reading them in exchange for, some of the literature says like, and I don't think it was a one-for-one like this, but people were like, they were trading in their university classics for children's books, but essentially reading this material. This kicked off a wave of young people who were predominantly women, which I think is really cool, creating their own much more adult manga, which explored themes of like gender and sexuality in a way that was really transgressive for its time. An article I was reading about this by this Japan scholar named Sharon Kinsella, who might be a weeb herself. Who knows? Who knows if she qualifies?
Kinsella sounds Irish.
She probably would not like me calling her a weeb. She starts this chapter off like this. A limitless secret world of smoldering underground clubs where baby girls in bikinis wield submachine guns and Russian Inuits DJ in Elizabethan court dress. Gray catacombs of deserted, rain-swept streets where beautiful women in impeccable Nazi uniforms sport unexpected erections. Nameless back streets scattered with the limpid green lights of opium-soaked noodle shacks where Oxford dons chop up giant squid for hungry pairs of lusty French schoolboys. Such is the stuff that amateur manga is made of. The point being that this stuff was, like, definitely not for kids and very imaginative and very transgressive. Essentially, this is kind of just young women pushing back against cultural norms, maybe engaging with their fantasies, which, like, I feel like we've talked a lot about, like, fan art, or at least to an extent on here. Do you feel like that sounds kind of similar?
Yeah, totally. I think at least, like, reminds me of what we talked about in our Wattpad episode, too. Just kind of women, like, self-publishing fiction and sort of using that as an outlet to explore these things and to sort of express desire in a mediated way.
Yeah, exactly. And it's interesting that you use the term self-publishing, because, like, yeah, obviously the stuff was never going to be picked up by large publishing houses in the 60s due to its contents. So it was often self-printed DIY style with the use of portable printing technology. Amateur manga was also disseminated through ad spots in, like, niche magazines or at manga conventions like a Comic Market, which came about in 1975 and it's, like, wildly popular. Even from the earlier days, people who made and consumed manga were looked down upon by older generations. There was this general sense that young people weren't owning up to the duties of adulthood and, like, regressing into an infantile state by reading children's cartoons. Kinsella says that generally the concepts of individualism and, like, youthfulness were interpreted poorly in Japanese society at this time, which was more focused on this idea of, like, community instead. And so this idea of manga being a form of, like, escapism didn't really hold up well with elders. It's unclear the exact origins of the word otaku. Originally, it meant something like your home, but over time, it's become a pejorative term that roughly translates to nerd. And it was used in the 80s by consumers of manga to describe themselves as people who, like, have trouble socializing or don't like leaving the house. While the otaku had been the subject of scrutiny for a couple decades, they would become the center of an all-out moral panic in the late 80s when a 26-year-old printer's assistant named Miyazaki Tsutomu, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, murdered four little girls. When they captured him and raided his home, they discovered that he was an avid reader of manga and had been to Comic Market. And this sparked a public outcry about the kids basically not being all right and manga becoming a scapegoat for Japan's cultural degradation, or what was perceived to be a cultural degradation. Otaku then came to define, in the eyes of, like, older generations, all young people who they thought had forsaken their culture and communities and social abilities in favor of this, like, wayward art form. Again, this is a very crude rundown. But none of this was enough to stop the spread of manga, which was becoming something of, like, a phenomenon. And in the 80s is also when we see cosplay conventions begin to pop up as well, after the founder of this anime publishing company went to a sci-fi convention in the US and was so impressed by the costumes there that he wanted to make his own back in Japan for lovers of anime and manga. And he named the costume part of those conventions cosplay. And at these conventions, there are typically, like, four major subgenres of costume. There's, I think it's pronounced mecha, which are big robots. There are cyborgs, which are half machine, half human. There are furries, which I don't think it's to be confused with actual, like, the furry community, but, like, creatures that have fur on them. And then there are Lolitas, so, like, youthful, kawaii, often, like, female characters. And in keeping with the subversive gender play in manga, you were also able to do cross-play, so your costume could be, like, a gender reversal. So happening in tandem with the rise of otaku is Japanese culture slowly spreading across the world. In the 60s, Japanese shows like Astro Boy or Speed Racer started piquing the interests of a certain group of people in the US, sci-fi nerds. Why do you think sci-fi nerds would be like the first people to be interested in Japanese animation? Why were they patient zero?
Because a lot of it's fantastical, right? It might not be all science fiction, but it is like based in fantasy. And I think that would make sense. I also think I guess Astro Boy and Speed Racer would be sort of science fiction-y themselves. I don't know. I feel like there's a trick answer that I'm missing.
No trick answer. That's definitely one facet of it. There's also this great quote from this writer, Lawrence Eng, in a book called Fandom Unbound, Otaku Culture in a Connected World, where he says, "It is unsurprising that anime gained early traction among members of the American science fiction fandom. This is a community heavily interested in cult media outside of mainstream media distribution, such as shows that are off the air and not being distributed, or shows published overseas." I love that we keep saying this in every episode, but I wonder if sci-fi nerds are the original hipsters.
Well, maybe. No, it makes sense. Like, they're looking for the most obscure media to consume. That makes sense, yeah.
Well, yeah, I feel like the whole reason they're nerds is because they have this, like, intense fixation on esoteric media objects. Like, yeah, they're constantly finding new things to obsess over. At least they were before, like, geek culture became mainstream and, like, every local Chad was like, I'm a nerd because I love the MCU. But, like, you know, before that, nerds were kind of on the precipice of media in many ways. Give them their roses, you know what I mean?
No, nerds have too many roses. They need to calm down.
Okay, now they do.
You had the Big Bang Theory. You're fine.
Ew, foul.
Bazinga.
But yeah, Japanese animation and manga began to travel around the US by word of mouth. And also thanks to the invention of the video cassette recorder in the mid-70s, which allowed people to basically swap tapes with each other. So these guys were the first to start, you know, including anime in their sci-fi conventions and like hosting anime clubs. And interestingly, the literature refers to them as otaku. So the meaning shifts from, like, in Japan, people who read manga but are also just, like, general nerds. It shifts from that to a person who, like, specifically enjoys Japanese media like manga or anime because we're outside of Japan now. These groups were really active in the early days of the internet. They'd commune in forums like rec.arts.anime and later, like, the Anime News Network and Anime Nation, where they'd share and, like, translate Japanese scripts. In that Verge article I talked about at the beginning, Leonard calls the American otaku one of the more computer networked subcultures around, which I feel like every episode we are going to be saying that about every subculture. Since the sci-fi nerds had caught on so early, it was hard to get a hold of English translations of Japanese works. So many of them created DIY subtitles, which is called fan subbing, which they basically just make on their computers with this new subtitling technology, like software. Although some people were actually concerned that translating these works to English would result in like a Hollywoodization of anime, which is an interesting debate.
Yeah.
The 90s were when anime really took off in the West, though. Movies like Akira and Ghost in the Shell. Have you seen either of them?
I haven't, but I know that that's something that I should get around to seeing because people really love both of those films, especially Akira, I feel like.
Yeah, I think like these movies are so special, one, because like the art is incredible and whatnot, but also they do follow the manga tradition of containing more adult themes. And so these two like really blew up in the US. There were also three media companies. There was Nintendo, Sony, and Sega, which took over the gaming market. Characters like Super Mario and Sonic became really ubiquitous all over the world. Shows like Pokemon became global crazes.
Pokemon?
Were you a Pokemon girl?
My brother was when we were really little, so Pokemon actually, like, defined the 90s for me.
No. Did you watch any anime growing up?
I had brothers, and we lived on a street with mostly boys who were all kind of nerdy, and I would follow them around in the summertime, and so that exposed me to, I mean, obviously there was, like, Pokemon, was huge in our house. My brothers had all like the Game Boy games. I had a Pokemon Sleep shirt. That was my brother's hand-me-down. But like I was I watched Pokemon. I really, really liked it when I was little. Same with like, you know, like Yu-Gi-Oh! Yu-Gi-Oh! Was one of my first crushes, honestly. Beyblade, all the ones with like the toy tie-ins were like big when I was little. Then Inuyasha. Inuyasha was hot. I loved Inuyasha.
Inuyasha was, yeah, hot for sure.
Yeah, my mom like didn't really want us watching it because it was more inappropriate and like they swore, but like yeah. We loved that shit. So yeah, that one. I watched Sailor Moon when I was really little, but I don't remember it as much because again, like I just grew up in such a boy dominated household. I never really got into Naruto. I remember our neighbor lending us his like DVDs, but I think they were like actually in Japanese with English subtitles. And I think at that age, I was like a bit too young to be like reading and following along subtitles well. But yeah, I had some good exposure to anime, but I didn't really read manga though.
Oh, interesting. Okay, yeah. I really liked Yu-Gi-Oh! I loved Beyblade the most, actually. I liked Dragon Ball Z, Inuyasha as well. I remember everyone kind of running home to watch it on YTV, which was exciting. Yeah. I did read a lot of manga, and I remember when I stopped was because, and this is something that we'll kind of talk about later, but I was reading this one book, and you start to realize, so it's about a stepsister and a stepbrother, and halfway through you realize that they're like horny for each other. And I was like a kid when I was reading this, like 8. You start to realize that they're like horny for each other, or he's horny for her. And then at the end, it's like basically insinuated that he murders her. It's crazy. So I remember going to my mom and being like, I don't think I like this book. And no. She was like, don't read more of this, which is sad because manga's amazing. Yeah. And I loved Miyazaki, like every single Miyazaki mm-hmm. movie I loved. My siblings are, as I've said many times, older. So they grew up with like Nausicaa and Princess Mononoke. So they kind of introduced me to it. And I feel like this was when Miyazaki was also putting out like hit after hit when we were like children.
Spirited Away was like such a major film when we were kids, I feel like. And I love that movie, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Amazing. Totoro. Kiki's is my favorite, which I'll talk about later.
This episode is brought to you by Mubi, a curated streaming service dedicated to elevating great cinema from around the globe. From iconic directors to emerging auteurs, there's always something new to discover. With Mubi, each and every film is hand-selected, so you can explore the best of cinema streaming anytime, anywhere. Now showing on Mubi globally is My First Film, a meta-narrative on the art of filmmaking from director Zia Anger. Stemming from Anger's past work in performance art, the film blends fact and fiction as it recounts the attempts of a young filmmaker, played by Odessa Young, to make her first film. Its innovative and multi-layered approach to storytelling makes My First Film a unique watch from an exciting emerging voice. You can try Mubi for free for 30 days at mubi.com/rehash. That's mubi.com/rehash for a whole month of great cinema for free.
So yeah, much of the literature attributes the success of this kind of media, which was now mainstream, to the fact that America kind of realized that there was some really great cross-marketing potential in a lot of this. Like you said, the ones that were associated with toys were the ones you really liked. Pokemon mm-hmm. wasn't just a show. It started out as a video game, and then it became like an animated show. It became a trading card game, what have you. Pokemon Go to the polls. Pokemon cards.
None of us knew how to play with the cards. We just collected them. We knew how to play Yu-Gi-Oh, I think, but I had no idea how to play Pokemon. We just had all these cards.
I played a lot of Beyblade.
Yeah. I had an classic girl. My Beyblades were all pink. My brother and his friends used to go to Beyblade tournaments at like the X in the summer.
Hell yeah. What a time. Yeah. What a time to be a child. So great. But people weren't just interested in Japanese media in the US. Many of them were all out obsessed with it. It's kind of an interesting thing because I feel like in middle schools when it's always most prevalent, like my nieces, when they were in middle school and like late elementary school, were obsessed. It's like when you start like drawing anime eyes, like I was like really drawing anime figures on my like notebooks and was just really obsessed with it. My little cousin was like obsessed as well. She would like wear her hair all anime style. She was like obsessed with Naruto, which I find fascinating. I actually wonder why it appeals to middle schoolers specifically. Maybe it's because it's this like hybrid between the adult and then like the illustration. Like, it's kind of introducing them to these themes. So it's a little bit illicit, but then, I don't know.
Yeah, and it's like, it's cute, but it's not like babyish. Like, it's cute in a way that isn't like, oh, I'm looking at like Winnie the Pooh or something. Like, I don't know. And a lot of it like does depict sort of young adults, or at least a lot of the stuff we were consuming were like supposed to be sort of geared towards that age. And then I do feel like it was a little more grown up. Like, Inuyasha was more grown up. I don't remember what happened on Sailor Moon, but I feel like they were like teenagers, you know?
Yeah, I was just thinking about how it can't just be like America being like slow to the chase on the cross-marketing stuff. Like, there has to be this innate interest, right, in Japanese media. It can't just be like, I don't think it's all manufactured for us. I think there is something that we innately love about it. And I've been thinking a lot about why Americans specifically, or like North Americans, would be preferential to Japanese media over American media. I think we touched on a little bit of this just now, but like, what do you think? I have like a few theories.
Well, I think for as far as kids and teens go, it's like beautiful animated work comes out of the United States, but it's generally geared towards children, or I guess like adults if you're a Disney adult. But I feel like they don't really put out that much stuff that's actually supposed to be geared towards like tween and teen audiences. And I think that a lot of people still continue on their preference towards like animated work into those years, but it's just like, I guess, treated like it's something for kids over in North America. So perhaps part of it is that.
No, I know. I think like they're dealing with really complex themes. Like, so much of why Miyazaki was appealing to me was because it wasn't selling these like black and white fairy tales that Disney was. Like, Kiki's Delivery Service was always my favorite because it introduces children to such like complicated emotions. Like, I think the movie really deals well with depression in this really subtle way. And I think that's just so beautiful. Like, I think Miyazaki especially is someone who takes children and children's feelings really seriously. And it's so important. I think it's what makes him such a masterful filmmaker. Also, the fact that manga came from such transgressive origins, like, you know, it was taking readers, again, seriously, readers of all ages, seriously, in a way that a lot of American media doesn't. Not even just children's media, but just like pushing the boundaries in a way that American media refused to for so long. The creator of a community in the US called the Miyazaki mailing list has been quoted as saying, "American cartoons browbeat the viewer with pithy platitudes and morals of the story. Japanese cartoons engage the viewer and let or force her to watch actively and arrive at her own conclusions," which I think is apt. Part of me also wonders where the like individualism of an interest like this being so maligned in like a community or like socially oriented society like Japan, being more adaptable maybe to like a hyper individualist country like America, like where being an individual is the most important thing. So I feel like carving individual identity, like we've talked about in so many of these episodes, you're so able to do that in the US that maybe, like, this is just a theory. I don't know for sure. It might be a broad generalization.
Also, I mean, not for nothing, but I think a lot of these pieces of media, like we sort of mentioned, you know, okay, America is like an inherently consumerist country. And I think, like we discussed in our Disney adult episode, I think people like consuming things that they can then sort of like buy an identity around. And I think a lot of these works also come with that same sort of Disney
cross-marketing.
What's the word? Like, yeah, merchandising kind of appeal. And I think, I mean, I don't know, even just thinking about lately the sort of Sunny Angels craze or something, like people really like to buy little things. It feels different from having something Disney, but it's sort of the same effect. And there's just a lot of merchandising for a lot of like anime products and like a lot of anime media.
Yeah, I think the ability to like adorn yourself or like collect objects regarding that makes so much sense. And then I also think then there's this idea of Japan being this like very real place that to people in the West kind of feels like the antithesis of America, often in like a good way, like it's like the better version or like, you know, more aspirational. And I think a lot of scholars speculate that Japan has taken on a bit of like a mythic quality in the Western imagination as this kind of like real pilgrimage site that people can go to, but also this kind of like phantasmic, like exoticized place in the mind as well, which is like kind of this amalgamation of all of this like media that we're consuming about it. So it's like, it's a mixture of like, oh, the tangibility of, oh, I can go to Japan, I can see real Japanese people, but also having this mythicized version of it because of the media. So I think, like, ultimately I could see also how an American who feels disenfranchised or, like, disillusioned with their own society and its maybe, like, restrictiveness or, like, its pitfalls would turn their fixations onto a country that they perceive to be, like, the complete opposite of their own.
I also think, like, in American media, Japan gets treated as a weird place. And I'm using quotation marks that you can't see because this is a podcast. But I think just, like, any American show or movie that ends up interacting with Japan as a place or Japanese culture sort of depicts it as this, like, sort of weird, crazy, loony place, you know, like the Japanese game show kind of stereotype that gets kind of thrown into, like, sitcoms and stuff. And I think that perhaps in, like, the American imagination, like, that's so ingrained that people who feel like they're weird or different feel some kind of kinship with Japan solely based off of the stereotyped perception of it in America.
Mm-hmm. I think the idea of just difference in general, right? And, like, the idea of othering, it's, like, this country that's been so othered in America, right? If we're even thinking about, like, World War II and, like, anti-Japanese propaganda, thinking about this relationship and, yeah, the way that Japan has been slowly kind of, like, taking this visual shape in America for so long now, that completely checks out. I do think it's important to say that Japan having the cultural influence that it does is not entirely accidental, and it's also not specific just to America. Have you heard of the term soft power?
No.
Basically, like I said, Japan's economy was soaring from the 40s right up until 1991 with the end of the Cold War. Around this time, Japan had entered a recession due to a bursting of its bubble economy in 91, which I will not explain because it'll break my brain and yours and everyone listening if I try to do that. But despite what would become a decade of poor economic performance in Japan, there's this writer, Douglas McGray, who noted back in 2002 that Japan's cultural influence continued to soar anyways. He calls it Japan's gross national cool, which is essentially part of, like, a pointed strategy on the part of the Japanese government after World War II to reinvent Japan on the world stage. And it only grew exponentially. This is what they call soft power. So it's kind of like, instead of hard power, like America, for example, having this, like, military power, pure economic power, Japan has this, like, extremely strong cultural power as well. The way that they've been able to maintain it is through the distribution of what they call global commodities. So manga, anime, video games, it's like a cultural strength. So while the economy was soaring and then took a downturn there, they were able to stay afloat on the world stage because of this cultural influence. This one scholar, and I am aware that many of these scholars are white. I don't know how this ended up being the case. I was looking through JSTOR for so long, and just somehow many of the articles about these topics are written by white people. I am aware of this disparity. This one scholar named Ann Allison says that the US had prior to this been the only country to really have soft power. Like, if we think about the 50s, especially in, like, the global influence of, like, greasers and, like, diner culture and whatnot. But she says that America's soft power really started to wane at the turn of the millennium because of the war in Iraq, essentially. It was, like, a globally unpopular move. This is when people started to get really critical of the US and US culture. So Japan's soft power gets even stronger. Okay, so all of this, Japan's global spread, soft power, the radical origins of manga, the sci-fi nerds, and the rise of the American otaku, Pokemon, all come together to bring us what we have today, which is the weeb. Yay! Hannah's looking at me and she has a carrot hanging out of her mouth like she's Bugs Bunny.
I'm so sorry. I'm, like, on half mute because the neighbors are hammering something to a wall and I am sort of, like, slowly munching on a carrot, but, like, not real. Like, I think it's just, like, I'm orally fixating on this carrot, but I am listening.
Cool.
Back to history.
Amazing. What shocked me when I was researching was that it was really hard, like I said, to find evidence of weeaboos in the way that they've been defined. What I found instead was almost entirely just, like, criticisms of the weeb. And I had to sit through some fucking punishing content for this, guys. So, like, you're welcome. This was a sacrifice. Basically, I was like, okay, what is a weeaboo? I search it on YouTube. And the first videos that come up are just like, I hate Weeaboo videos. The first one was by a guy named Filthy Frank. I'm sure many of you know who he is. I wish I didn't. And essentially, it's an 11-minute long YouTube video just called Weeaboos in all caps. And it has 41 million views. This was a brutal watch. Just very, like, man yelling at camera rant style, like, doing obnoxious voices era of YouTube.
How does he have so many views?
I don't know. I think it's just, like, more pure time of YouTube where, like, these are the kind of videos that really hit. I mean, even with Destry Moore, who's one of the YouTubers I mentioned in the Emos episode, like, his one video called IDEK 9.5, it's just him kind of, like, being silly and ranting, and it's, like, a 7-minute video, and it has, like, millions of views. Like, I think it's just, like, there were less people on YouTube at the time, less saturated, whatever, easier to blow up. This one's from 2014, though, which I think is too late for this kind of content. Like, I'm like, this guy's too old also to be making shit like this. Anyways.
Call him out. Just wait. He's going to make a video hating you.
Well, he actually famously quit YouTube. But basically, Frank makes that classic distinction between people with a general interest in Japan and those who claim ownership over Japanese culture but are not from there. Frank is explicitly disparaging of the Weeaboo. He calls them stinky. He calls them heavy breathers. He calls them pedophiles. Frank is also part Japanese and condemns Weebs for praising what he says is one of the most xenophobic cultures that exists. Which I thought was interesting. I guess, like, he feels like people are obscuring the cultural complexities of Japan or, like, its history with fascism. He also mostly characterizes weebs as grown men who watch hentai, like, guys who are obsessed with, like, big titty anime girls and, like, hump body pillows. And he ends the video with a song that's accompanied by a compilation of private pictures that he clearly, like, scraped from MySpace or something, like, people's personal MySpaces. Mostly, the pictures are, like, of fat people, mostly fat women, in anime costumes, which I guess that's just supposed to be a joke in itself or something, or nerdy guys hugging body pillows, wearing, like, fedoras. And the song at the end goes, one of the lines is, Konnichiwa, senpai. Please notice me. I watch Asian cartoons. I'm a weeaboo. I live in my mom's house. I'm, like, 32. I collect swords and throwing stars. Yes, I'm a weeaboo. If that gives you a sense of the general characterization. Then he ends the video by being like, I discriminate against everyone, and that this can be applied to, like, anyone who has an obsession. People fucking love this video. It came up, like, a few times in the articles I was reading. I was like, this better be good, and it wasn't. All the comments are super positive. Like, they were like, Frank spoke the truth, and then he had to leave YouTube because he spoke the truth.
Wait, he left YouTube over this video?
No. I think he just quit, like, a couple years later. There's also a video called Five Differences Between Weeaboos and People Who Like Japan by a Japanese YouTuber named Sora the Troll. I actually watched Sora the Troll back in the day, but, like, obviously I was a kid, and going back to this, I was like, oh, cringe. This one's less of a rant video than Frank's. It's more of, like, a skit video where he, like, plays a bunch of different characters. And again, it's, like, a pretty hyperbolic portrayal of, like, this kind of false binary between weebs and non-weebs, where, like, weebs are the ones who feel entitlement over knowledge of Japan, as opposed to, like, non-weebs who just have a general interest in Japanese media, like the good weebs, kind of like an otaku would. I do have to say, though, it's just kind of funny, because, like, every single video I come across of making fun of these, like, nerd losers are also made by people who are, like, extremely nerdy.
It's the Spider-Man meme.
It's a little bit Spider-Man meme, for sure. Although I totally get, obviously, the element of, like, yes, there are people who fetishize Japan. And that should be criticized. This did kind of make me wonder whether being a weeb is just kind of, like, nerds almost treating Japan like any other media object they consume. Like Dungeons and Dragons or, like, Marvel comics. And I think that's maybe where the dehumanization of Japan comes from in this, is because it's, like, nerds are the ones who are doing this.
Or... do you think that, like, in a sense, like, Japan itself has just been so mystified, so dehumanized, that Japanese culture almost feels like it itself is from a cartoon in the eyes of Americans, that it's, like, not just the media that's coming out of it, but it's just, like, everything they do is treated as such, because it's almost like they're just not taken seriously? Is that...
that might be from the soft power angle. There's a 2017 Vice article, because, like, of course there is, where the writer interviews a bunch of people that she considers weebs at an anime convention in the UK and asks them what they think of the term weeaboo. And I thought their answers were really interesting. The ages and genders and, like, races of these people were all pretty diverse. Everyone seems really nice, if not just kind of, like, shy and socially anxious. One person was like, what's wrong with having a hobby? someone said they consider being a weeaboo the same as being like a super fan, which is kind of interesting because it's hard to know if they're trying to say that they're a super fan of Japan or if like being a fan of Japan is their hobby or what they're fanning over is like anime. Like they didn't really specify. I do think that distinction is pretty important because like,
yeah,
if we're talking about being a super fan of Japan, it's like, yeah, that's when Japanese people become objects to you and like that's when they're fetishized. They're objects for like consumption rather than people. But if they're talking about like media, then that's a different story, obviously. Like I think anyone could be a fan of any media. I'm sure we know lots of people who are fans of like Nollywood, you know, because like again, also American culture was a huge source of fascination in Japan for years. So like when I think about this conversation also, I'm like, sometimes it is natural in a way for like people to kind of not fully understand the nuance of a country that they've never been to or live so far away from. And like the same happens in Japan. Like there has been a lot of like fascination with Western culture in Japan from Japanese people. And I think this happening between Japan and the US is because of this like fraught history between the two countries. So I don't know. One person says that they are not a weeb, that they are an otaku because they see themselves as like an outcast who stays inside, which I feel like a lot of people who someone would call a weeb would call themselves otaku because they think it's less derogatory, which is kind of funny because otaku back in Japan was considered a derogatory, like pejorative term, even if it's like imposed on the self. Many people said that they turned to anime because it was like an escape from being bullied or alienated. Another person was like, basically, I don't think that Japan is just anime and manga. It's still a country with cultures and people going about their daily lives. Even me wearing this, a kimono, I made sure I'm wearing it correctly. If someone wore my traditional dress, I'd want them to wear it properly. It's not that I'd go especially mad if they didn't. It's just polite that you've shown attempts to be respectful. Another person said that the reason they think weeb has a negative connotation is because there was an adult manga publisher in the 90s who was publishing it as cartoons, which made people buy it thinking that it was for kids, which is kind of funny going back to my experience with manga. So people kind of thought this content that weebs were consuming was like perverse in a way, which reminded me a lot of like the sexual deviancy conversation we had in the furries episode. Like maybe some people think that weebs are like sexual deviants. That seems to be what he's getting at.
Yeah, I guess I've never really thought about weebs in that capacity. Like to me, a weeb, I always just see like a nerdy like tween or teen. And I know there are like adult weebs, but I understand that like the existence of like hentai and like those body pillows is a thing, but I've never really like, for some reason in my mind, like I've never really kind of factored that into the identity of like being a weeb. I think that that's its own thing, and like people can be interested in different things related to Japan without it all being kind of an umbrella.
No, I think so too. I think like a lot of it just comes down to like a personality thing more than anything. Like I just think like a weeb is kind of like a Western otaku who like happens to maybe be a person who's a know-it-all or gets obsessive about things, or maybe is like ignorant towards the culture they're obsessed with, which is definitely bad. But for the most part, it also feels like a lot of otaku in the West, or like a lot of these people who I would consider a weeb, are really reverent of Japanese culture and like know a lot about it in a way that makes them actually more respectful of it because they're like so interested. Like a lot of them take the time to learn the language or like learn the traditional dress. And so those are people I had always thought were weebs. I didn't realize there was like this distinction. I think like there are, of course, weebs out there. I remember like I watched this one Jubilee video and there's this redhead girl in it. I think it was like a dating video or something. And she was like, I want a Japanese man. Talking about Japanese men like she was collecting Pokemon or something. Like it was strange. Instead of just like, oh, human being, it was very odd and fetishistic. But I also think the term weeb is a bit like the term hipster. Like when you said the Spider-Man meme thing, it's like, it feels like because of the negative connotation, no one wants to be a weeb. And so you end up kind of like pointing the finger at each other, even though maybe you're all interested in Japan and kind of doing the same thing, but like there are just variations or different shades to like how respectful you are about it, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, it just seems like it's a term being applied to like a lot of different facets of interest. Like I'm picturing kids who are really into anime, but I think you're mentioning people who are interested in like a more traditional aspects of Japanese culture. Trying to rack my brain for other examples of this sort of cross-cultural fascination extending as far as it does.
India, Buddhism, oh, yeah? Hinduism. Oh my God. The Hare Krishna.
Right. Right. Of course.
If we're thinking about like the Dharma bums, like, you know, people being like even the hippies, you know, and like Buddhism.
But then I guess like in that sense, The difference being is that with the weebs, or like with the way some people are about Japanese culture, is it's an obsession with like the people too, though. Like it feels like it does extend to something else where it's like, I feel like people talk about Tokyo like it's Disney World or something. Like I really do.
Well, again, it's the soft power thing, right? Like I think Japan, because if we're thinking about why this is occurring with Japan specifically, it's because of Japan's like global soft influence. Like I think that it's so ubiquitous. And then also I think a lot of it stems from just like people being far away from it. And of course that's bad, and like that leads to dehumanization, but I'm just trying to think of like the psychology of why people would be like, oh my god, that person's so cute. Like obviously it's stemming from like maybe basic racism or xenophobia, but it also has to be stemming from something else as well. And I think it's just like the otherness, you know, the difference. I don't know, I just think like, of course, criticism of weebs from the fetishization angle is extremely founded, especially from Japanese people. But I also think sometimes the hate from everyone else is coming less from being upset about that and more from just like hating on nerds, or just like maybe nerds hating on nerds, you know what I mean? Sometimes I think it's just from this like deep-seated sentiment also that adults shouldn't have hobbies. Like I think there are strange parallels when I was reading about the otaku. I feel like there are kind of strange parallels between them, because like again, you're getting this characterization of weebs as like a person who spends all their time at home having Peter Pan syndrome, being obsessive over cartoons, and it's like, why are they grown adults doing this? And that was kind of the exact same criticism of otaku back in the 60s. And so I think, I don't know, it's just fascinating. And like 60s and 70s and 80s.
It's also the criticism of Disney adults.
Exactly.
Right? And I think it just depends, I guess, on like, I don't think that any of these interests are inherently negative. I think, I guess, it's just how people engage with them and the capacity to which they engage with them. Ultimately, people's annoyance just stems with, like, we don't like anyone who's really into anything online. Like, anyone yeah. who's vocally interested in anything is inherently annoying to us. And then once we do consider the fact that the thing that they're interested in is something that is stereotyped as nerdy, then of course, like, of course it's going to be laughed off. I think there's like a ton of factors at play. And I think, I also wonder if there's criticism coming from two different camps, right? You have the people criticizing it because they see it as fetishistic, or they see it as cultural appropriation. And then you have the people criticizing it because they don't get it, because they themselves find Japanese culture strange or different or nerdy or whatever, like negative stereotypes they're like attributing to it. I think there's criticism coming from two different groups and two different
a third group sides. Which is Japanese people.
Well, yes, of course.
I just feel like at this point it's just unhelpful to say the same thing over and over again, like these people are nerds. That's kind of why I just think maybe a more helpful discussion or guiding question we should have is just like, why are so many people adopting the cultures of other countries so far from their own and like rejecting Western culture? And I think that that was like a helpful way for me to think about weeaboos, instead of just being like, these people are idiots who are ignorant and they're losers. Because I just don't think that that's necessarily the case for everyone who I would consider a weeaboo. I just think instead of writing people off immediately as like nerd idiots, we should think about like why they are the way they are. And so hopefully we were able to do that a bit with this episode.
Even just starting the episode and sort of reflecting on like all the Japanese culture that we consumed as kids. And like, I wasn't even necessarily thinking about this going into it, like how much anime like I watched as a kid, because I think, like you're saying, at least for our generation, like I think a lot of Japanese media was like so adopted by North America that it didn't even like stick out to me that I was consuming like foreign television shows as a kid. It was just what was on TV.
Well, and that's a whole criticism from another angle of subtitles on these shows and people not really understanding like the cultural context with which they came up. But that's like a dubbing. Whole other debate in itself, but it does speak to that sci-fi nerd concern about like the Hollywoodization. Like I think that is another aspect, like kids not knowing where something came from could also be like another criticism almost of maybe what like led to this, but I don't know.
Yeah. I think Japanese media was very ubiquitous for our generation, at least growing up. I think also bringing it back to Gwen herself, we were kids at a time when like that was this sort of actual fetishization of Japanese culture and like racist depictions of Japanese women in the ways that she was doing with the Harajuku girls went unchecked by mainstream media and by a lot of people. And I think that's worth considering too, is that like Japanese culture was just generally very fetishized, at least for our generation growing up, and like not in a way where people were concerned about cultural appreciation over appropriation or anything like that. It was just things kind of were able to slide under the radar or like unchecked that they wouldn't today. But then I think maybe influences the way at least some people around our generation had engaged with Japanese media and would maybe like allow for people to like embrace it in these ways that feels obsessive, but not like be questioning themselves in doing so.
Is this where I get to end off the episode with a Gwen Stefani impression?
Oh my god, yes.
Harajuku girl, you got the
I can't do anything.
That's pretty good. I feel like Jen just entered the chat.
Who's Jen?